This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, the Biden administration is looking to crack down on gun dealers who don't follow the law as part of a wider effort to reduce gun violence. Get the details of the new plan tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester, New York, announced it will be the home of a new National Archives of Game Show History, the first of its kind. They hope to honor all the people who have shaped the industry from over the years, from big names like Vanna White from Wheel of Fortune to behind-the-scenes stories from producers. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite game show of all time? Do you enjoy game shows or have some memories of watching them? Were you ever a participant on a game show? Love to hear what that was like, or part of a studio audience. Do you think they're an important part of our entertainment culture? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Chris Bench is chief curator of the National Archives of Game Show History at the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester. We started a conversation with him earlier this month. Had some technical issues, or whammies, if you will, on our end. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob. Great being here.
Well, remind us, we talked to you just briefly before, remind us why we want to pay attention here to game shows as part of our pop culture history.
Well, I think the competition right now for the replacement host on Jeopardy makes clear that loads of people care about game shows, about their impact on popular culture, their impact on our lives, and that it's essential that we preserve this form in a way that hadn't been attended to before now.
Right. Can you talk about how maybe it's been overlooked so far? We don't have museums and archives tackling our game show history.
We don't. So I was thrilled about a year ago when two veteran producers of game shows came to us and said, we're missing out. Our legendary performers, our back of the house sorts of professionals, lots of people are passing on. We're missing out on preserving their stories. They have been such a big part of American popular culture, really from the days of radio, almost a century of game shows. And today, they are more present than ever before. More nighttime hours of broadcast television are devoted to game shows than even at what we consider the peak. And I bet loads of your listeners are current watchers or have heritages of their favorites from days gone by.
And if you're listening and you do have a favorite, you can call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What is your favorite game show? Do you have a favorite host? Have you ever been to one? Call 800-642-1234 as we talk to Chris Bench about a new National Archives of Game Show History. Chris, those stories you mentioned, that's going to be a focus, right? Can you talk about the sort of, oral histories you're hoping to collect?
That's right. We do want some of those front of the set kind of people, those hosts and hostesses, those announcers that we all think of when we think of our favorite shows. But we also want the multitude of people who go together to make these shows happen. Who could think of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire without the lighting designer who created that dramatic spotlight effect when people are answering questions, or the jingles and sounds, or the mechanical devices that turn clues on the screen, and those have moved into digital realms. So much, so many facets of craft and artistry and forethought to make these successful products.
Well, you mentioned Jeopardy. I want to give a listen to a moment from the long-running show, a bit of a funny moment from contestants Max and Kevin on the show, the category Most Populous Nation.
Populous Nation, 400.
Israel, Lebanon, Syria. Max.
What is Israel?
No. Kevin.
What is Syria?
Right.
Nation, 600.
Switzerland, Sweden, Swaziland. Max.
What is Switzerland?
No. Kevin.
What is Sweden?
Right.
Nation, 800.
Pakistan, Bangladesh, Indonesia. Max.
What is Pakistan?
No. Kevin.
What is Indonesia?
Yes.
Most populous nation, 1,000.
Portugal, Colombia, Peru. Max.
What is Peru?
No. Kevin.
What is Colombia?
Right. Oh. No fun for Max, but a good run for
process of elimination there, I guess, Chris. And that, I mean, that also illustrated one of the things that I liked about Jeopardy. It's like bang, 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 question after question, not lots of chit chat in between. I don't know. Is that part of the appeal of why Jeopardy is such a standout among talk shows or game shows?
It is. And in fact, I was participating in a conversation with one of our co-founders, Bob Bowden, recently, who's produced so many shows. And his analysis of Jeopardy was the top level of questions, or I should say answers on the board, are ones that practically everyone can get. In between that and that bottom row, there are lots of ones that you can say, oh, I almost knew that, or you can shout out an answer. And that lowest row, the most difficult ones, are ones that you sort of say, wow, that's fascinating. I never knew that. So different ways for all the viewers to feel good about themselves as well as excited about shouting out those answers in their home, family room, or living room.
Now, getting back to the archive, you're not just interested in oral histories. You're also, I understand, hoping to get some stuff. What kind of physical artifacts are you on the hunt for?
We would love things called shell scripts. That's what the overall structure of a game show episode looks like, because it's very structured and thought out beforehand. I am currently getting tickets from game show studio audience members. I am waiting for the delivery of a category card from a winning participant on the $20,000 pyramid. So things that represent the studio audience, represent the contestants, represent the craft that goes into making these shows. All of those are things we hope to get. Plus those really showy items. We want the wheel from the Wheel of Fortune if we can get it, or the pyramid from Pyramid.
I know, I believe with your other exhibits at the Museum of Play, there are some hands-on and interactive things. Are you, Chris, going to host your own game show there?
I am looking forward to that. In fact, we have game show contestants on our staff here. Our archivist, Julia Novakovic, has been a contestant on Jeopardy, on Millionaire as well. So she can speak to what it's like being on the set. And we are hoping that everyone, when we get around in a few years to doing a game show exhibit, you'll feel like you are the contestant right there with the answers, meeting the challenges.
Now, of course, when I think game show, I think TV game show, Chris. But I think you've mentioned before to us that a lot of these started, this whole genre started on radio, which I want to hear more about. Are you looking to tap into that era as well?
That would be lovely. That's reaching a little bit back further into our history. So, but people transitioned from radio to television in so many ways, whether that was variety shows or comedy. And maybe there are a few long-term veterans who got their start in radio and have those memories to share with us today. I would love to get that continuity.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Oleg is with us in La Crosse. Oleg, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about?
I want to tell you, I am a first-generation immigrant to America. My parents immigrated when I was 12 years old, and I remember the first game show that caught my attention was The Price is Right with Bob Barker as the host. You know, can't get much more classic than that. And I remember, you know, I was 12 years old, and my English wasn't even perfect yet. And by rights, what did I care about prices of consumer goods? But Bob Barker has had such an inimitable style and was such a great showman that I tuned in every day to this show, just to hear him, take people through this game of guessing prices of consumer goods.
Awesome. Oleg, thank you so much for sharing that story. I want to give a listen to The Price is Right. Contestants here guessing the price of a Honda Elite 80 motor scooter to get a chance to participate on stage.
And you get to bid on this first, Barbara.
$1,700.
$1,700, Michael.
Exactly, $2,148.
His bid is $21.48. That's an interesting bid. How did you settle on $21.48?
I seen that on there last week, and that was the exact price. I know that's what it is. I've seen it. I watch you every day. I watch you every day, Bob.
Well, Oleg and that contestant watched every day, Chris. And also we heard on Facebook from Brandy, who has memories of watching The Price is Right. Ah, and I remember doing this too, when Brandy was homesick as a kid. The Price is Right. Could you talk about where that stands as you're looking at the history of game shows?
You know, some of these shows are truly evergreen. They go on for decades, and people sort of pass them along as family traditions. Is this what you do while you watch, as you have dinner every night or before dinner or some kind of structure? So we really build so much of our behaviors around some of these shows that get incredible longevity and incredible loyalty from the audience.
Oleg, thanks a lot for calling in and sharing your story. We are talking about game shows, past and present, with Chris Bench, chief curator of the National Toy Hall of Fame at the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester, New York. Their new addition there, a TV game show history archive, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite game show, past and present? Was it a routine for you to watch this show at this time every day? Have you ever watched Jeopardy at a bar with friends and strangers trying to beat each other to guess the answers? Do you have a game show that just didn't strike you as a very good one? Why? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
Support for WPR's Mike Simonson Investigative Reporting Fellowship is provided in part by a gift from Frank L. and Mary E. Nicolay. The Mike Simonson Investigative Reporting Fellowship helps WPR provide in-depth news coverage throughout Wisconsin.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Chris Bench, chief curator of the National Toy Hall of Fame at the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester, New York. We're talking about game shows, their history, their new archive at that museum, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Want to hear your favorite game show or your favorite game show watching memory, or if you've ever been a part of a studio audience, you could share that experience too. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard on Facebook from Darren when we asked about shows, Match Game. And Chris, that reminds me, there were a whole bunch of shows back in the 70s, I think, and early 80s that I remember watching as a kid, often what maybe while homesick from school. They often had B-list celebrities who I only knew because they were on, like Paul Lynde on Hollywood Squares. What are you looking for to tell the story of that era, of those shows that aren't with us anymore?
That is definitely something that taps into my personal memories. Yes, Hollywood Squares was one of my guilty pleasures when I was home with the flu and a little bright spot in the draggy day of drinking ginger ale and napping. So those kinds of things, yes, those B-list celebrities who took that niche on the television game shows and ran with it. And one of the things that I love is that so many of us wanted to be on those shows so much that we bought the board game version. There were so many of those out there. Password, Hollywood Squares, Jeopardy, Price is Right. All of those had game versions for the home audience, and you could play it around the card table and see whether you could do as well as the TV contestants.
Well, now knowing you as I do, Chris, I'm guessing that the Museum of Play already has some of those home games on hand, right?
We do. So I've been looking for those. We have them in tabletop versions. We also have them in their computer and video game versions. And we are looking for more. We don't have all of those. So I just told a donor that we would love about 50 of his personal games of that home consumer variety.
Well, if you have the home version of a famous game show, love to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Still time for you to call in with your personal favorite game show of all time, 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Chris, we're hearing from more people online than on the phone. Maybe that means something. I don't know, but we heard from James, who says the most interesting game show he ever watched was called Mastermind on the BBC when he was over there for a summer. He always thought PBS could try an American version of the show. I have never seen that. I know there have been a lot of game shows, including Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, that have moved from country to country.
There are, and Mastermind has a reputation amongst game show fans of being really brainy. And I can see why the PBS connection is there. And there was also a really successful, very popular home version of Mastermind. So that is an excellent one. Some of these are out there on streaming services, and some of them are also available for easy pickup on things like YouTube.
All right, here's a, Chris, a philosophical question that I put way too much time into thinking about over the years, and it matters for your archive. When Survivor came out, right, people call it a reality TV show, but people were competing to win a prize at the end. It was Survivor, and are shows like that game shows that'll fit into your purview there?
That is such a perfect question, Rob. We were just having that conversation last week as we were defining some parameters. And the famous quote about pornography was, I know it when I see it. And sometimes game shows are what you believe them to be. Is it The Bachelor? You're winning a spouse, or any of those dimensions. They're on a sliding scale. It's even trickier with things like cooking shows, where you're showing off a skill, you're winning, you're competing. I am most inclined to think of the ones that your listeners are bringing up so far, the ones that have an established host, have a studio audience. Some of those, they're definitely the classic core definition of what a game show is, but it gets blurry, as you say, around the edges with cash prizes and winners and losers on loads of those reality shows.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Lynn is with us in Racine. Lynn, hi.
Hi. Yes, I've never been one to exercise on a regular basis. COVID and Drew Carey and The Price is Right, though, have got me into good shape. I exercise with Drew every morning at 10, with very few exceptions. So thanks to Drew and The Price is Right, he's my little guilty pleasure. That's my favorite game show.
Lynn, do you guess the prices? And do you ever guess the price correctly?
Not the price on the nose, but yeah, I play. And I've actually gone to see the live show, the traveling show. I've taken my mother and my son. So, I have done that.
Fantastic. So. Lynn, thank you so much for sharing that. So Lynn fits into her exercise routine. The Price is Right. That's probably the right level of concentration for me. That makes a lot of sense, don't you think, Chris?
Yes, that's about my endurance capacity to do a half-hour game show. Perfect.
I love it, Lynn. Thanks for that. We'll go to Marcus now in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hey, no whammies, and stop. Press your luck.
That, you know, it's funny, Marcus, because the big bucks, no whammies, that phrase sticks with me. I have to really think about which show it came from. That was Press Your Luck, you're saying?
Yeah, it was Press Your Luck. The other one I liked, though, was, stay home from school kind of sick day. Was Hollywood Squares with Joan Rivers.
With Joan Rivers. Okay, Marcus, thank you so much for sharing that. Chris, Hollywood Squares is at that rotating cast. I know Paul Lynn was the center square. Joan Rivers was on it. Gilbert Gottfried was the center square for a long time. I don't know. It's providing a lot of work for celebrities over the years.
It did. And there were writers behind all of that. So they were sharp comedians, but they needed good content. And what we forget is they had lines and quips given to them, and they were scripts and jokes that we would love to capture and preserve for all time.
Marcus, thanks for a lot for that. And that reminded me, the catchphrases of, you know, is that your final answer? Big bucks, no whammies, Marcus just mentioned. Survey Says from Family Feud, which we haven't talked to. Those are ways that they've really crept into American pop culture, Chris.
That's part of our language. Everyone understands those structures and those phrases. So, yes, they are really integral to who we are today.
All right, Chris, I got to ask you the big question. Would you be good on Jeopardy? You know, in the moment, you're actually there in the studio. Do you think you could pull off a win?
I had a friend from graduate school who was on, and she was a smart woman, but she said her downfall was her buzzer skill. She wasn't hair trigger enough to actually press the button and get ahead of the other players. I worry that that would be my downfall.
All right. And do you have a favorite show of all time that you'd love to go back and watch and maybe feature prominently at the archive?
I was a pyramid guy growing up. And as the price range has escalated, I will date myself by saying I was watching when it was merely the $20,000 pyramid.
Excellent. Chris, thanks as always for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks, Rob. You're a winner.
You too. That's Chris Bench, Chief Curator of the National Archives of Game Show History at the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester, New York. He joined us to talk about the brand new archive they have there and the impact of game shows on American pop culture and entertainment history. You can still let us know your favorite game show of all time. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page, scroll down a bit to find that conversation, or you can always tweet us at Central Time WPR. Tweet us at Central Time WPR, just with the name of a game show that you love or loved in the past. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, lots of people in Wisconsin and around the country provide care to family members with Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. We'll get advice, resources, and comfort for caregivers from the author of the new book, Six Steps to Managing Alzheimer's Disease and Dementia, A Guide for Families. That's tomorrow here on Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, there are lots and lots of books and workshops and tools and apps out there that try to help us make the best use of our time, promoting time management and productivity hacks. The author of a new book takes a different approach. Instead of focusing on being more efficient and getting more done, he wants us to accept that we'll never get it all done. Time is limited. You'll never have time for everything. And that's good news if we know what to do with it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you tried using time management advice from a book or an app or whatnot? Did anything work for you, or did you feel as busy as you did before, or even busier? How do you make time for the things that are important to you in your life, whatever those may be? How do you decide what's important for you to spend your time on? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Oliver Berkman is a journalist and author. He wrote a long-running weekly column on psychology called This Column Will Change Your Life for The Guardian. His new book is called 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. Oliver, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks very much. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, 4,000 weeks. When I found out what that meant, it's a little disturbing in a way. What's up with 4,000 weeks, Oliver?
4,000 weeks is very approximately the number of weeks you're going to get if you live to be around 80. I definitely rounded the number for for effect. But I think that what's really important about that number is not really the exact figure. It's just that any life, even the sort of record-breaking, very long-lived people who sort of live until they're like 120, it's all so finite. When you think about it in weeks, it's 4,000, maybe 5,000 if you're lucky. It's not a lot.
You have tried lots of other time management advice over the years and productivity tips and things like that. What is the focus of a lot of the stuff out there that you see steering us in the wrong direction?
I mean, there's good stuff as well as bad stuff, but what there is and what I was for a long time is this phenomenon of people using this advice to try really to feel completely in control of time, to feel like they have their lives in working order, to feel like there is nothing that could be thrown at them that they would be unable to deal with, no ambition they could have that they couldn't put into practice. You know, it's this kind of omnipotence that I think we are seeking and that a lot of productivity gurus are encouraging us to try to achieve. And my argument is, you know, number one, it's not possible for a finite human to be omnipotent with respect to time. Number two, it's not even a worthwhile thing to try to do, because what it does is it actually undermines your ability to have time and focus for the things that, that matter the most to you in life.
Yeah, this idea that if I'm just efficient in how I use my time, I'm going to get to do all the stuff that I want to do, that other people want me to do. I'll keep up with my work. My house is going to be clean. I'm going to make great meals. Like, right, you can't do it, can you?
No, right. We live in, especially today, I think it's always been true in some sense, but especially today, because of technology, the economy, a lot of other things, we live in a world of what I call infinite inputs, right? There's always another email that you could be sent. There's always another demand your boss could make. Likewise, you know, there's always another exotic location you could have on your bucket list. It's not all unpleasant things, but it is all these kind of limitless inputs. And trying to get more efficient at getting through some limitless inputs is like, you know, getting faster at climbing up an infinitely tall ladder. You feel more rushed, but you're never going to get to the top of it because it's infinite.
So the core of your book, it seems to be, it's a mindset change. What is the mindset you're hoping to shake us into here?
The mindset I'm hoping to shake us into, which you know, absolutely is one that I have had to struggle with myself and still to some extent do struggle with, is to just see the facts. Just understand that getting on top of everything, doing everything, it's completely off the table to begin with. It's not that you failed to find the right time management technique or that you weren't self-disciplined enough. It's like trying to make 2 + 2 add up to 5, right? It's not going to happen. Once you see that, and once you can deal with the discomfort that arises from that, because it is an uncomfortable realization, at that point, you can instead choose to put your time and your attention onto a handful of things that matter the most. You have to give up this feeling that next month or next year, that's when you're going to be fully optimized, totally efficient, totally in control. Because of course, anyone like me who's struggled to try to achieve this feeling, like it's always off in the future. It's never now. It's always like you're just being led towards like maybe it's soon, but it actually never happens. And I think giving up hope in that respect, admitting defeat in a certain way, is actually the first step to being way more effective when it comes to using your time on things that you really care about.
Talking to Oliver Berkman about his new book, 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have trouble deciding how to best spend your time? Do you feel overwhelmed trying to do it all? Have you had a realization that you can't do it all? How do you prioritize what is important in your life to spend your time on? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Oliver, I'm going to describe a feeling I often have, and I'm guessing from your book, a lot of people have it. I'm doing a thing, watching a movie, playing a computer game, hanging out, whatever. At the back of my mind is the fact that the thing I'm doing means I'm not doing all the other cool things I could be doing or important things I could be doing in the world. How do I shake that? How do we shake that?
Well, again, I'm not sure you should shake it. I think you should kind of almost go deeper into it and see, like, that feeling is reflecting the fact that every time we decide to do anything with an hour, with a week, with a lifetime, we are, by definition, right, neglecting a million other things. It's just the way it works to be a finite human. And I actually think that's one of those feelings that it's most tormenting when you sort of feel it a little bit. It's less tormenting when you really stare it in the face, because then you see, sure, you know, I'm always going to be missing out on stuff. Never mind the fear of missing out that, you know, is supposed to sort of ruin our lives these days. It's the inevitability of missing out. And I think once you accept that, you can sort of stop beating yourself up for the fact that you're choosing one thing over another thing. And that's when you can make better choices and you can ask, like, okay, is the thing I'm doing right now with my time the most meaningful thing for me in my circumstance in life to be doing it? So it's kind of really liberating to give up this hope that one day you're going to somehow be able to not miss out on things.
how do we do that kind of arranging, figuring out the things that are important to us or that are going to make us happy or fulfilled or whatever good thing we're looking for? How do we sort that out and then put it at the top of that list for some of our buckets of time?
It's a really good question. I mean, in the book, I do get into some really sort of down-to-earth little tips and techniques, but I think that the most important point is this kind of, it's this mindset shift that we're talking about. It's this willingness to tolerate some discomfort. And I think it is just this recognition that a lot of the things that matter to us the most don't always feel really comfortable. They don't always feel really good. If you're working on a difficult piece of creative work, or you are looking after a child who you love deeply, something like that, you're going to encounter like resistance, boredom, the feeling that it's too difficult and you want to do something that feels more pleasant, like, you know, just scroll through your phone on social media or something. And that's fine, because all you're feeling there is the fact that I think the things that matter to us do bring us up against our edges and our limitations. They do challenge us because the stakes are higher. And I think just sort of expecting it to feel that way makes a huge difference, because soon it then, you know, I don't think the discomfort always lasts. I think you can get into sort of deep absorption and fulfillment from doing these activities, but just not expecting any of this to be like super comfortable right from the start, I think makes a massive difference.
We're talking to Oliver Berkman, journalist and author, about his new book. It's called 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. He says, instead of trying to get so efficient that we can do it all the things we want and have to do in our lives, we are probably better off realizing that we're finite. We don't have that much time. We can't do it all. And that's going to help us realize what's important, what we want to spend our time doing when we have the choice. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Does any of this ring a bell with you? Did you realize that, hey, maybe there are some things I'm spending a lot of time on that don't bring me happiness or joy or fulfillment, and I can stop them or maybe spend less time on them? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-123 with your thoughts, your experiences, maybe your questions for our guest. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin-Madison, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
The eighth season of Wisconsin Life on PBS Wisconsin offers plenty to get excited about. Host Angela Fitzgerald connects viewers with people whose passions, experiences, and expertise celebrate the best of Wisconsin. New episodes air 7 p.m. Thursdays on PBS Wisconsin. Episodes are also available to stream at pbswisconsin.org and on the free PBS video app, on streaming devices and smart TVs.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk now with author Oliver Berkman. His new book is called 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. He says, no matter how much time management and productivity training we get, we can't do all the stuff we want to do in life or feel like we should do in life, and that's okay. And knowing that is actually going to help us pick and choose and use our time in good ways. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you tried time management advice in a book or an app or whatever? How did it work for you? Have you realized there are things you can leave out? You don't have to get through every email, say, in your inbox. Your yard doesn't have to look perfect. So you can use that time on better stuff. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring out a caller now. Destiny is with us in Milwaukee. Destiny, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
I really appreciate the guest speaker talking about how you just sometimes may be uncomfortable with these realizations. And something that really helped me was to stop using the word should, especially as a new mom. I constantly am telling myself, like, you should be doing the laundry, or you should be helping with the yard work, or whatever that may be. And realizing that if I just changed the word should to could, I was much more comfortable with what I was actually choosing to spend my time on. So I could be doing the laundry, or I could be making a phone call to a really good friend, and just feeling still fulfilled with what I was doing.
Destiny, I'm glad you could make a call to us. Thank you so much for sharing that. Oliver, what do you think of what Destiny had to say?
I think that's just a fantastic point. I think that, you know, the word should is so interesting because you can generate a list of 100 things that you feel you should be doing. There's no reason to believe that that is going to be, that you're going to have enough time for all those things, right? I mean, maybe you've got time for 5 of them. But so our minds are capable of this kind of limitless level of, you know, beating ourselves up for all the things we're supposed to be doing. And it just sort of floats free of the basic math, which is like, there are so many hours in the day and you're going to have to sleep for some of them. And you should try to give a little bit of time to resting and to doing things for yourself. So I think it's a great, great point. And of course, there are things that we feel duty bound to do, but it really makes no sense to think that we're duty bound to do more things than it's humanly possible to do. That's just a non-starter.
Destiny, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Oliver, reading your book, what I thought about a lot is my experience with vacations. Once upon a time, if I'd paid the money to go somewhere and taken the time to get somewhere and knowing I probably would never get back, I'd have the mindset that I have to see every single thing there is to see and eat all the foods and, you know, all the stuff. And then I said, you know what? No, I'm going to just enjoy bits and pieces and know I'm going to miss stuff. And I enjoy traveling a whole lot more when I get the opportunity to do it. That I don't know. That's what I thought about reading your book. That mindset I should maybe take from my travel to the rest of my life.
I think it's, yes, I absolutely. I mean, I think what's going on there is this way that we almost turn leisure into another kind of work.
Yeah.
And what we're doing there in work as well as in leisure is really focusing on the instrumental benefits of time, right? We're thinking about time entirely as something that we're using for some future purpose. And in the case of vacations, it's the future purpose of that lovely satisfied feeling that you really got the most out of your vacation. But if you completely fixate on using time for future benefit, you're kind of not present to the time itself, and the present and the future kind of never arrives. So you miss your life. I think it's a really good point. I think it's actually worth thinking about vacations and days off as an opportunity to waste time. Like, almost, I think we need that in our culture these days. We're so wired to try to use all our leisure time well. It's almost a challenge to try to almost deliberately do something that has no benefit for our careers or for the future or for our families, et cetera, et cetera.
Talking to Oliver Berkman about his new book. It's called 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. Still time for you to share your thoughts, your experiences, or maybe your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. If you'd like, that's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Oliver, you've mentioned here and you write about this. You're working toward this mindset shift. You're encouraging it for others, but it isn't always easy, even for you, having worked on this for some years now. What are some of the roadblocks you've encountered?
I mean, I just think that I have, and I think a lot of people have, a pretty deep-seated notion that we need to do a huge amount of stuff. We need to be incredibly productive, not just to pay the rent and to make our lives sort of work out financially, which we do. I accept that. But to feel like we've justified our existence on the planet. You know, there's a whole self-worth piece built into this where you kind of think that it would be somehow immoral if you spent the whole day In the park reading a novel. Now, you might not be able to spend the whole day in the park reading the novel because of your financial situation or your employment situation. But if you get those little chances, even for a half an hour here or there, like, I think the big challenge is, like, don't make it into a thing where you're like, you feel like you're not justified in existing unless you are producing stuff. So that for me has been a big challenge. This notion that, like, you're enough regardless of what you produce, and then sure, go ahead and produce some things and accomplish some things because that's good to do, but not as the condition of your, not as your sort of price of admission for being human, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, and you write about, and this is getting more toward the practical side of things, I think there are a lot of things we can do that might feel productive, but there may be distractions from the good stuff, or whatever the good stuff might be. How do we tell one from the other?
Well, we live, don't we, in this culture that sort of really, really champions doing things, kind of almost regardless of what the things are. If you get to the end of a work day and you, like, did a lot of stuff, you're liable to feel very virtuous, like you did your part. But there's no virtue inherently in just doing things. It depends what things. So yeah, I think there are a lot of techniques and approaches to this. A very simple one is that if you have the control over your work day, not everyone does, but if you have, to really try to spend the first 2 or 3 hours on something that really counts and that really matters, and to just not touch the inbox or the little bits of admin until after you've put in those 2 or 3 hours. To resist this urge to say, well, okay, I just got into work, I'm going to clear the decks, get everything a little out of the way so that I can focus. Because of course what happens is you never clear the decks. In fact, the act of trying to clear the decks just generates more stuff on the decks. So, putting what matters the most first for a sort of ring fence 2 or 3 hours in the day is an incredibly powerful practice, I think.
I want to get a little more into something you've mentioned a couple times now, the idea that at some point in the future, I'm going to have the time to do the stuff or the resources, when I have the good job or when I retire or when the kids move out or whatever. What advice do you have for us to take that future and start working it into our daily life now?
Well, I love this insight that comes from a creativity coach called Jessica Abel, who says that, you know, this idea from personal finance about paying yourself first, in other words, putting a bit of money into savings as soon as you receive a paycheck instead of hoping that it'll be left over when you've spent all your, you know, paid all your bills and bought your groceries and everything. The same applies to time. If you think that, writing a novel, writing songs, or nurturing a specific relationship in your life, whatever it is the thing that you really plan to do when you get the time, the only way is to do a little bit of it right now, you know, to do a little bit of it today, even if it's half an hour, even if it's 20 minutes, even if you don't feel ready or qualified yet to do that thing. Pay yourself first with time. Do a little bit of that right now and keep doing that as many days as you can. And just accept that, yeah, you're going to feel like, no, I wanted to wait a few years until I was in the right frame of mind. But just understand that that's a trap.
Leslie in Cottage Grove emailed us. Leslie says, once you're retired, you have a great sense of time's limits and it becomes easier to choose to spend time on things that personally matter. I can work on whatever I want to. Well, I want to spend the last half a minute, Oliver, remind us the realization that we can realize those limits of time right now and start working with it.
Right. I mean, I really take that point. I think it's excellent about retirement, and I think it really does liberate a lot of people. But the difference between someone in retirement and someone earlier on in life, like, we're all on this. It's not that huge. We're all in this very short little span of time, and we could all do to, I think, spend a bit more time on what we care about the most and a bit less time convincing ourselves that we one day might be able to do everything.
Well, Oliver, thanks for using some of your time with us today. I appreciate it.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Oliver Berkman is a journalist and author. We've been talking about his latest book. It's called 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. You can still share your thoughts, maybe your own advice. Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR.